listening to the Norfolk Chambers of Commerce podcast. We're connecting voices right across Norfolk.
Thomas, thank you so much for joining me today. It's really good to be in our freezing cold office, but I'm not putting the heating on because there's only us two here.
Yeah, I know. A bit of a waste, isn't it?
Yes, totally would be. So we're here to talk about Canopy.com,
yep.
Formerly Greener.
Yes.
You are just so busy. I don't know how you find your 10-day week. How many people I talk to have a 10-day week? I think you really do. And we met through our Business Climate Leaders programme here, so you're on our advisory board. Thank you so much for being involved with that. That's amazing. And I know you're really committed to sustainability and creating a new exciting marketplace. Could we just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
A lot.
Yeah, we can talk about it this whole podcast.
Yeah.
No, thanks for having me. And it's okay, we're both wrapped up, so don't worry about it being cold. So Canopy.com, formerly greener.co.uk, is really here to make sustainable shopping. We want to make it to the mainstream, break out of the eco-conscious echo chamber, and give it to more people. And that means bringing, you know, verified sustainable products from great ethical brands under one roof, under one canopy, and then also backing that up with real evidence and doing that research for the consumer, right? So that they don't have to be experts. You don't have to be a climate scientist to understand why this is a better product. So it makes that whole process of buying what you want to buy when you want to buy it, but without the guilt of buying on places like Amazon or wherever else, much, much easier. And a part of that is building in quite innovative tech into the back end. So for us, we have built a calculator with the marketplace, which quantifies the carbon emissions, water waste, and the plastic waste that you save when you buy these products compared to their mainstream alternatives.
There's a lot of noise, isn't there, about sustainability and greenwashing and people colouring things off. Your podcast earlier this morning about greenwashing, where people will just colour things green to make them seem better.
Yeah.
I think it is confusing for customers and people wanting to be more sustainable.
Absolutely.
What to pick.
It's also really frustrating for companies that do it well, because then you're completely diluted in your messaging because big companies, you know, manipulate that. You know, Coca-Cola is a great example of this. They have, you know, a billion plastic bottles every year, and they claim that a lot of it is made from recycled plastic, but it's less than 1%. And then that's what they talk about. Recycled plastic, but that's such a small amount of their mission. And that makes it really hard for the consumer. You're going to believe what you're told, right? And that's totally fair. So for us, this has been everything about what we're trying to do is to make sure that we back up those claims, but also just make it, you know, sustainable at a glance. So you don't need to do like lots of reading and research. I think one thing that really excites me about that space, though, is new regulation. And I think there has to be, you know, businesses can do so much, marketeers can do so much. You know, we can come on podcasts and talk about it. But ultimately, whilst companies are still able to get away with saying what they want, you're always going to have that problem, particularly when they've got budgets of, you know, millions and millions of pounds every month.
Well, you need legislation to come in
and
actually police all of that, don't you, and stop that happening.
And we're getting it, right? Like, so the Competition Markets Authority have just released this year their Green Claims Code. That's a fantastic new piece of regulation and legislation, which will effectively develop. It's not perfect yet. It will get better. It will become more strict, but it will clamp down on companies making, you know, they've already clamped down on like HSBC, ASOS, Boohoo. They still need to do more, but, you know, this is great.
And it's good to see those big companies being clamped down on, because it sells everyone else who are smaller businesses. You can't get away with it, even if you are a big
company. It makes it easier for startups and smaller companies to grow effectively and efficiently, because we're at the stage where it's so much easier to sort of mold our business into whatever we want it to be. It is much harder to do that when you're a big company. You know, I spent 5 years working for the world's largest independent environmental organization, Greenpeace. And you learn so much that, you know, you're part of a lobbying group to make things more sustainable and more ethical, but you also realize how slow and hard it is for big, huge companies, corporations, and governments to change. And that I'm not letting them off the hook, because they need to, but you have to then take a step back and be like, well, it is, you know, you have, for example, I heard today that Amazon has 500,000 workers. Changing that entire supply chain and workforce is difficult. They need to do it quickly, but you have to respect that, I think, in that it takes time. And for us, we're in a position where, you know, there are three of us. So it becomes so much easier to just go, well, okay, that is terrible, like, let's never do that, and then build that into our governance and in our policies and build from there. And regulation helps that.
Yeah. I guess it's easy to hide behind red tape, isn't it, for yeah. businesses, but actually it's just getting rid of that red tape,
yeah.
which is just a huge barrier, an invisible barrier,
yeah.
a
very real one. Very red, but very invisible. Very red. It's a weird one because I think they do hide behind it, which is the problem. And I'm sort of contradicting myself in saying that we have to respect that as well, because really, you know, they shouldn't use that to defend themselves. You know, you can respect someone's restriction, but that doesn't mean that those restrictions should stop you from changing, right? And I think that big companies, big corporations and governments need to sort of, you know, take a bit of humility and realise that the time at which people will believe that and just give them the benefit of the doubt is past. And, you know, like I say, you're seeing regulation come from government, which begins to clamp down on that now. And I think that you will start to see that red tape sort of being cut and falling
you
away.
You need a big pair of green scissors to cut.
Yeah, all of these are analogies. But yeah.
I guess the thing is, like you mentioned time, that's the most important thing, because with climate change, time is ticking and there isn't, you know,
yeah.
we're up against it. It's got to happen before it's too late, and you need that legislation in, debunked, whatever, right now.
Yeah, it's really difficult as well, because obviously we're sat in quite cold today, England, and we have it very easy. You know, we had a few days of extremely hot weather. This was our first real experience of quite extreme climate events. But, you know, that's 1 week of the year. There are countries which experience this every day of the year. You know, Pakistan, 33 million people have just been displaced by floods. And I think that when we talk about the climate crisis in this country, obviously there's only so much we can do as individuals. We have to work with what we've got, we have to work within our means, but it does need to be quicker. And it's not just a matter of it being quicker so that we protect our grandkids, it's a matter of it being quicker so that we can, you know, adapt and mitigate to the changes that are already happening now around the world. And that is across all sectors, right? It's not just one sector.
Yeah, but it's about education as well, isn't it? I was watching recently the climate change walk in Norwich a couple of Saturdays ago, and we were talking to my 8-year-old son, and a lady said to us, "Don't scare him, you're scaring him." To which I said, "No, we're actually just informing him and giving him the facts.
Yeah.
Stop burying your head in the sand."
Yeah.
But then it's just quite an angry
It's really
space.
Difficult.
I think it should be in schools.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was taught about physical geography in my GCSEs. In my A-levels, I did geography. You know, we're talking a decade ago, and we were still taught mainly just about, like, physical geography and anthropologic geography, but it wasn't really about climate change, and because they cross those boundaries. Climate crisis crosses all of those. And I think that I speak to people who are now in school. You know, I went and spoke at East Norfolk Sixth Form College, and they are learning about this now, and that's really, really positive. You know, I think that it's fantastic that this is being brought into the curriculum. It's being talked about and taught. However, I think the education piece is really important, because we have spent 50 years or more as climate scientists sort of using the stick, right? This is how bad things are. This is how bad things are going to get. We need to change. This is really problematic. You're doing this wrong. And they're all absolutely factual and quantifiable and things which are, you know, true. But it doesn't make people very willing to change. And we've seen that now. The evidence of that is very clear. People, you know, bury their heads in the sand, get quite defensive, get angry. I don't want to change my lifestyle. Governments, I don't want to have to completely change our system. All of these things. And that is really a problem of communication. So the education piece, yes, you need to speak facts. Yes, you need to bring truth to the problem. And that is scary. But I went to a fantastic talk by the Grantham Institute of Climate Research based at Imperial College on Wednesday. And Brian Eno was actually the keynote speaker for whatever reason. And he, I didn't know this, but he works within the climate space now as like an activist and sort of, and he has a company called Earth Minutes, I think that's what they're called, anyway. And they donate to charities doing good stuff. Anyway, his keynote speech was about this point, about how we get people and governments and corporations to change now, because what we've been doing hasn't been working quick enough. And he basically was saying we need to use more of the carrot and less of the stick. Yeah. You know, if you start talking to people about the vision of what the world could be, you know, free, renewable, micro-serviced energy, food which is healthy but tastes amazing and is cheaper. You know, we're talking about vehicles which are quiet and non-polluting and smooth driving. All of these things sound fantastic, right? It's like from a sci-fi movie. Well, this is the truth. If we change the things, that's what we're going to get. And that excites people, right? That's like, oh, I want to get there.
Yeah.
So if we start talking about that vision and we start talking about what we could have if we make these changes, you take the pressure off of, oh, everything's so depressing, and more to, I want to change as quick as possible.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, I think. And that's really important. We need to tap into.
I think the recent petrol crisis, where everyone can see the queues and, you know, queuing for your car, and then all the electric people just driving past going, I want that. Why can't I have that now?
Yeah.
Why are they so expensive?
Yeah.
I just need it. There was just a brilliant article about you on Virgin as you were in the startup. What I wish I knew. And there's a line you say where it's, we're often very focused on the challenges rather than the opportunities and possibilities. And I think that's it. That's the crux of where people say, I don't want to change, because there's nothing to change to that they can see.
Yeah.
But actually, it's about shouting about what there is.
Yeah. If you tell everyone that there's no hope or there's no future, well, people become greedy. People are like, well, I want to live my best life now. Because, okay, it's really sad that my grandchildren are going to live in hell. But, you know, that's, you've told me that that's happening anyway. So what does it matter? And I think that, you know, that's a pretty black and white way of looking at it, but that is essentially what we're dealing with. And I think when we look at, you know, opportunities, costs, challenges, from a founder's perspective, they're exciting, right? Because we can solve these, we can bring innovation to it, we can be visionaries and ambitious and laughed out of rooms by investors and all of these things, right? But as individuals just living our lives and just wanting to work and to provide for our families, I think it really is just about talking about that opportunity of what is available to them as well. The energy crisis is a really interesting one, because I think it's been lost with the fact that it's tied with a war.
Yeah.
So people go, oh yeah, but it's because of Russia invading Ukraine. And there is truth in that, you know, supply chains have been disrupted and the gas link between Russia and Europe has been obviously forcibly shut a lot of the times by Russia. But the truth of the matter is that finite resources are finite for a reason. And we have gone past that tipping point. People in the climate sector have known that for many years, but now it's starting to be felt. And I think what will happen, my prediction of this, is that over the next year or two, when everything in Russia, Ukraine begins to cool off, which it inevitably will, these things eventually find a solution, much as it should never have happened in the first place. What will happen is that people will still realise that oil prices and gas and the non-renewables are really expensive. And that is just because that's how it is now. Put that with other solutions that are coming out, like carbon taxes and things like this, like people are going to start feeling that crunch even more. And I think what we'll see is people demanding renewable energy more from a normal person perspective, not an eco-warrior.
Well, it's heating your home, isn't it? Some people are heating or eating, which you just think, in this day, how can that happen?
Yeah.
How can that happen in this country?
You know, we're the sixth richest country in the world, and we're going to have energy blackouts and, you know, people not being able to, you know, heat their homes, let alone feed themselves as well because of that. We take pride in being a great country, but these are things which shouldn't be happening in a country of this much, with this much wealth.
I think that's all. I don't say wake up call, because I feel like wake up call, that's just like a trigger, isn't it, for people about getting angry.
I think wake up call makes sense though.
It does. Yeah, they do need it. But it's like walking out here when it was 40 degrees from the office. If that isn't, when your skin, you can feel your skin burning through a t-shirt. If that isn't, you know, this is cold England. If that's our wet summer, that is a wake up call. We're in Norfolk. If rise, we're going to feel it before.
Yeah.
People in Northumberland.
I think also, you know, fundamentally what it comes down to is changing the discourse from, yeah, but I like warm weather, that's why I go to Spain, to you go to Spain for hot weather. You don't stay in the UK for hot weather.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
And that realisation needs to be sort of, and I think this is the first year we felt it. So you're going to get quite a lot of people still who go, that was a nice summer, wasn't it? And I get it, right? Because we usually have okay summers and it's pretty dreary in the UK, but that is the UK climate and we should know that by now.
We're born knowing that.
Yeah, yeah.
But old, you know.
Yeah, yeah. We're like born into the cold. Yeah. I mean, we're saying this, and people in like Norway and Finland are going to laugh at us. But and then I think what will happen is as this becomes more common, which it will. You know, we've had the hottest summer on record every year, like for the last decade or whatever. And I think that you'll start to see people go, I don't like this, and or this is really not right, particularly as it will continually get warmer than that. You know, this is just, you know, this is the coldest summer of our lives, right? Yeah. That's how I try and phrase this. Like, yeah, that was hot, wasn't it? But that's actually the coldest summer you're ever going to experience again. And it's like,
yeah, actually,
that's pretty insidious. So, you know, those sorts of things are scary. But again, the opportunity within that is that, well, if we start radically changing things and supporting companies and policies that do good, then actually you're going to end up with a much better, not just climate, and like, you know, that will take time to change again because it has a knock on, but just like lifestyle, and you'll be able to afford to stay cool and all of these various things which are going to have to be adapted in our society now.
It feels like the society is now adjusting to so much. We had lockdown where we're all in, and I guess that's where like the consumerism, particularly for like me and my family, changed, that we were in and we thought, we don't need as many clothes, we don't need this. That's like a big part of your new site will be, but just about buying things well, thinking well.
Yeah, I think there's sort of, just to go back a little bit, people have crisis fatigue at the moment. So the problem with the climate crisis is that it's been around for decades now. And we've been talking about it for decades. Now we're feeling the effects of that, but that's also come with multiple other crises at the same time, and people can't handle that. We shut down to that because that's human nature, that's how our brains work. And I think, again, this is why it's so important not to make it all about the crisis aspect of it, although that is why we're trying to change things, and more about what we can solve. Exactly why Canopy.com exists, because we all, I think there's a fundamental issue in the climate movement of perfectionism, which actually hinders progress a lot of the time. You can't have a zero emission product or a zero emission business. Net zero for all of its, you know, wording and buzzword is ultimately, you can never be a net zero company without using offsets, for example, because you're always going to have an impact. As soon as you have one person working for you, you've got an impact. They're eating, right? They're coming to the office, maybe they've got energy use. So that, you know, there's all these things. So perfectionism often hinders the progress that we need to make in the climate movement. I think we're starting to see that now. So with Canopy.com, we're trying to feed into the fact that you're going to buy things, particularly things which can't be used secondhand, right? Cleaning, cosmetics, some clothing, right? You can't always get a secondhand underwear, for example, right? Like, who wants to do that? No, not many people. So our whole thing is, well, if we can give access and you know, provide a, you know, fun but also safe place to continue shopping in the way that you want to, but know that that's going to have a better impact than you were previously buying, then that's a good thing. The other side of that is that when you buy a more sustainable product, we tend to focus on it being a better product in general, because that's what the sector demands. You know, if you're having something which cares for the environment from a good company, usually that means better materials, better quality, better work ethics, better longevity. And ultimately, all of those things mean better for your wallet in the long run, because you don't need to buy it again and again and again and again. This is something which is so important in our space, which is that if I buy this reusable water bottle, I do not need to then buy the average 47 plastic bottles a year that would replace that. Through studies, we can see that's the sort of average use of plastic compared to a reusable. Then multiply that by how many years this lasts. Well, I'm saving huge amounts of money in the fact that I've bought this one product for, you know, five times more than a single plastic use bottle, right? And I appreciate that a lot of the time there's a discourse about the affordability of better products. But again, I think that conversation needs to be about future and about the opportunity of buying these things, because then you end up saving money in the long run. But you also, you know, fundamentally have a better product than you would. You know, clothing is a really good example of this. If you buy a t-shirt from Primark's cheapest section, you can be pretty sure that it's going to be fray and damaged within 6 months, maybe even shorter than that. Whereas if you buy something from you know, Yes Friends or Patagonia or, you know, any of the great clothing brands that are now coming out of the climate space and the sort of impact-driven space, those clothes last you a very, very long time. In the same way that Levi's jeans used to last you a very long time. We need to go back to that sense of, I'm going to buy this thing and it's going to last me a lifetime, that mentality. I think it's really interesting. It's kind of contradictory because we get told by our elders back in my day, and we sort of scoff at that a lot of the time as young people. But what's really interesting now is the innovation, and for those listening on the podcast, I'm putting that in inverted commas, is often just circular in the sense of its economy as well, in sense of what that business is. We've just gone back to the 1920s. Like, these things were already being done. Refillable milk bottles, for example. There's a company raising money at the moment called Dizzy, who do reusable packaging. So they'll send you stuff and then you empty it and use it, and then you give the packaging back and it will go back into the system. Well, that's just the same old milk bottles that we used to have, right? Like the milk floats that used to go around cities. Yeah. They still have those in some places in the country, in Sheffield, for example. So, you know, I think that what's really interesting for me is just watching how we as a species always end up going full circle. And this is across everything without going into too much depth, whether it's politics, whether it's ideology, whether it's theology, all of these things come back around. But I think that with sustainability, a lot of our solutions lie in things that we used to do. They need tweaking, they need improving, they need to, you know, we've got new innovation which can make it easier and more tech-based and all of these things. But we can learn a lot from what our past generations did. And yes, my grandma was around then, by the way. She's 95 in 2 weeks. Wow. So, yes.
So I guess in the 50s, you had that mass commercialism everywhere in America and in the UK.
Yeah.
60s, 70s, more sustainable, more, you know, thinking 80s, buy everything. You've got to have bigger, better.
Yeah.
It's so different now. Thank goodness it's so different now. We should be thinking that way. Is that where Canopy.com came from, that where you just wanted one space? Because obviously you can go out now, you can buy small products, you can buy who gives a crap toilet paper, all from separate places. If it was all in one, and that's why Amazon, to swear, is so good, because for people pressured for time, get the best deals, everything's there and it comes tomorrow.
I mean, even going a step back from Amazon, supermarkets exist for a reason. They give you all of your groceries in one place, and that's really attractive. Now we're moving to a more digital age. Amazon has dominated a lot of this, also other stores as well, but they are having a terrible impact on the planet and often selling really terrible products from terrible companies. And I think that that's exactly where we're coming from, is that you cannot solve the climate crisis by making people's lives harder, right? Like, this is something in the climate movement we have never been able to get our heads around. And I think that I take a very bullish stance on this, that if you're asking someone to stop doing something which they are so used to and like doing, one, you're going to have to wait many decades for that social consciousness to change. And two, it's unlikely that the majority of people are going to do it. For example, stop driving. Don't be ridiculous. People aren't going to stop driving, particularly in countries where driving is so needed. So these are good examples of why we can't just, you know, completely sort of devolve in the economy we've built. So what we can do is we can look at models which people love. Amazon, they own 30, you know, over a third of the online sales in the UK now. People use them because of convenience, they use them because it's quick, they use them because it's affordable, albeit their prices have gone up. And I think that we are looking at that and going, okay, well, if we can offer convenience, basically the whole package, but with better impact, and then also give positive reinforcement to why these products are good, so people feel good about themselves as well. Because we lose that with shopping a lot of the time, right? You might buy a nice dress and be like, oh, I feel really good in this, and that wears off after a time. If you can talk about the impact that that product is having, and then you can bring people back and engage with that data and engage with that sort of emotive response, you create even more of a circular model of sort of buying better to begin with. And that's exactly why we started Canopy.com.
And that's where education comes in. If you were brought up knowing that, I guess it's the people with the most disposable income are the older.
Yep.
We've got pensions and we're happy because we're probably the last people to have pensions and we're really happy. But it's engaging with that group because they've got the spending power.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting when, I mean, Hugo, my co-founder and, you know, great marketeer, he looks deep into sort of customer segmentation and sort of how different people respond to the climate movement more generally, but also sort of climate conscious shopping and various other things. And one thing that we have separated, you know, widely here, I'm talking, and he probably slapped me for talking so top level here, but is that for younger people, they're impassioned by the movement and the vision and the future, because that's their future. And often we can engage with them on an emotive level, but also they're more interested in the stats, right? They're really passionate about, this is better, look, this, I can tell you this is better because of this. For the older generations, the way that they are encouraged to do something is by their kids and by their grandkids. So if you've got your grandkid coming home and talking about what they learned in school with the climate crisis, or we should watch Blue Planet by David Attenborough, or all of these different things, suddenly the older generation become more switched on to it. They're the ones with the money to spend in this space as well. So what we've found is that a really good way to engage that community is by, this sounds really insidious, but using younger generations to influence the older generations. One thing that's also really interesting is that the way that digital has changed, sort of digital marketing and digital engagement. So Facebook, traditionally, when I grew up, was the platform that we were on. That isn't really something that you go on for any generation that's younger than me now. So what that means is that Facebook's a really good way to then go and speak to those older generations once you've engaged their kids on Instagram, TikTok, wherever else. And I think that this is a really interesting change we're seeing just generally in how you engage people with business and marketing, whatever, but also with the climate movement, is where you're actually speaking to people. Because if you're trying to engage young people on Facebook, you're not going to be reaching people enough. Even though they probably have an account, they're not looking at those ads. Whereas if you're talking to them through engaging activism and engaging public campaigns, and then using Instagram Reels and TikTok and talking to people in a way which relates to them, then you can go on Facebook and talk to their parents and their grandparents, and they'll have that conversation and discourse as a family. That's how you change people's sort of perception and behaviour.
I mean, there's something really interesting on your website. There's some really good points about consumerism. And yeah, it says ethical consumerism in the UK has grown 4 times in the last 20 years, and 32% of consumers find buying sustainably too complicated.
Yeah.
And that is that older generation, isn't it? If it's not... You know, I guess all of us think, if I can't get it now...
Yeah. I think it's really interesting. So the intent to shop more sustainably is pretty vast within younger generations, and still quite dominant in older generations, because if you went and asked someone, would you like to buy more sustainably, I'd be quite shocked if they said no,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But the actions, the percentage of actions is very different. Older generations are more likely to act on that feeling, probably because they've got more money, probably also because they've got more time to do the research.
Mm-hmm.
For younger people, they might really, really care, but the beauty of using something like Amazon or Depop's great because it's secondhand, but you know, these sorts of platforms, is that it fits with their convenience, it fits with their disposable income, and also they don't have time to go and research all of it, even though they might already know a little bit. So for us, it's about giving that convenience and accessibility in one place for the younger consumers to still be able to do that and still be able to afford it. But then also have all the information there so that, you know, the grandma or grandpa or retired father or mother who is sat with a bit of time on their hands can go and look through the research that we've done and can read more about it and become a bit more engaged with that sort of action of consuming more sustainably and understanding why we're doing that. I think with younger people, we're quite spontaneous in how we act. So we're sort of engaged and fired up by something and then we'll go and do something straight away. So once you've sort of engaged someone of that generation into this movement, it's easy to keep them there. For the older generation, it takes a bit more convincing. But if you've got that there and they've got the time to look at it, then great, right? So if we can sort of build that into one platform, then you begin to make it much easier for both of those demographics.
It's so exciting to have that out. So you've just finished all the crowdfunding.
Yeah.
For people listening, you've just got really tired.
Yeah, I just like collapsed. So we've just closed £270,000 of investment, which is fantastic, particularly during this time. We have a whole handful of different ways of raising money during this time. So we have funds like the University of East Anglia Enterprise Fund, the Capital Pilot Boost Fund, who backed us. We've got angel investors, so people who have done very well for themselves and now have money to reinvest back into young founders. They're really great. But they also bring lots of like insight, value add. They're usually founders themselves or have been, so you can get a lot of mentorship from that as well. And then we did a crowdfunder as well. So the whole thing for us was, we're democratizing access to sustainability, right? So we want everyone to be able to own a piece of that journey, be a part of that movement. So the beauty of doing a crowdfunder was for £15, you can own shares in a company, which, yes, is for profit. So there's a monetary side to this as well. If we're successful, you're successful. But also, you can then walk around the street knowing that you own a piece of this great movement. It's not some arbitrary thing that's happening that you're just buying from, but actually you're a part of it. So we have like 340 people now who have come in on that to be a part of that movement. That's amazing. And also incredibly validating and humbling for us, because we are in an economic crisis. There is an energy crisis. You know, people are rightly sort of a bit more risk averse at the moment and a bit more tight belted, and we have just been so grateful for the amount of people who are willing to put, you know, I couldn't care whether it's £15 or whether it's £15,000. The point is that you all came behind us to support what we're doing and believe in us as founders to do it. So yeah, we've closed the investment round. Very exciting. We've got lots of people ready sort of to build with us, and but now we actually have to go and do it.
This is the, well, I would say this is where the real work starts. Yeah. Actually, you've done it. But it's interesting that you talk about risk, because with things like investing money, whether it's 15 or 15,000, you'd be so easy to buy Christmas presents for and trick you. I guess there is no risk in it, because it's going to be happening, and this is the way the world is going to have to change and go.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a security investing. You know, this is not investment advice, so, you know, I need to make that absolutely clear. And obviously all risk investments carry risk. But, you know, I think that you can be pretty damn sure that climate-focused startups, companies, initiatives, movements are going to grow and have more gravitas and more power. And ultimately, you know, we've seen Chris Sarker, who's one of the most successful investors from Silicon Valley, you know, he's backed like Instagram and various other companies. He has a climate tech fund now that invests specifically in startups which are solving the climate crisis. And he's quite candid in saying that the next $1 trillion companies will be climate tech startups. So, you know, I think that make of that what you will. This guy's like super wealthy, whatever. But the point is that this is a culture shift. This isn't just a few activists on the streets shouting anymore, albeit they're still there. This is people who want to actually give you solutions and talk to you like a human being and understand the other struggles that you're going through, but give you that opportunity to have such a better life in the future. And I think that, you know, we're small, right? We have a marketplace with a calculator built in, but we have so many great, ambitious and exciting plans to give more back. You know, Amazon started as a online bookstore. Look at what it is now. We have just as, if not more, ambitious goals than that for the next decade or more. So, yeah, looking forward to that.
I'm exhausted just listening to you. When is it going to launch?
So we are going to have a beta launch. So this will be for anyone who's invested in the company through crowdfunder or directly for our email sign-up. So if you want to be part of that beta, go to canopy.com. And you can sign up to our emails and you'll get access to that beta. But also, we'll put a call out across our socials, and that will be a good way to sort of get involved as well. So that'll be for 3 months, and that'll be for us to engage, listen for feedback, learn from the people who really care and are passionate about what we're doing, but also want to make sure that it really works. And that's good for us, because then when we go public, you know, in spring next year, it means that we'll have a platform which we know quantifiably that people are happy with, and then we can just build from there. Yeah. So, you know, if you want to be involved early, come and get involved now. But if you want to sort of wait and see, you know, come and see the platform when it's probably a bit more ironed out, then spring next year.
And what about all the products and everything that you're going to sell on there? Yeah. Are they already behind the scenes ready?
Yeah, so we have 150 companies which have signed up to sell with us. Now, obviously, in the grand scheme of you know, international business, that's minuscule. But the point is that we are incredibly strict on the way that we vet companies. Mm. All the, this is the work that we do, so consumers don't have to, essentially. So you might come onto the platform in the first year and be able to access 1,000 SKUs, 1,000 different products across a range of different departments, from clothing to cosmetics to cleaning to homeware, to gifting, whatever it is. We've even got pet food. but, you know, I think that the point is that that will grow and continue to develop. So for us, it's about coming and supporting, buying what you can from us. We understand that Amazon is still going to be around. We understand that other companies, supermarkets are still going to exist. We're willing, you know, we're not here to say that that's going to change spring next year. But what we're saying is that we're building something which will eventually give you a guilt-free place to shop, and somewhere which you can be proud of supporting and being a part of. So for us, come and support those companies that are already there, come and encourage more companies to sign up, and then we can sort of grow that as a community rather than just sort of trying to solve everything at once.
Yeah, I think that's so important. Now people, you do want a community. It's not just about, I want to buy some plastic tap from Amazon. You want to just shop and feel good about all the products you're buying.
Well, 100%. I think that even just away from the shopping experience, like understanding the company that you're buying from, you know, understanding the love and thought process behind that product, also just generally being part of a business, a marketplace, which isn't just this behemoth organization which you know, see Jeff Bezos flying to the moon in a penis-shaped rocket. You know, it's not about that. It's about, you know, coming and talking and engaging with our community. And no matter how successful we are as a company, we as founders will always be there talking to people and being a part of it. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people who admire the really successful people in the world and their sort of like almost godlike status of just being at the untouchable. But I think that what we're starting to see generally, particularly in sort of younger generations, is a sort of disdain for that sort of culture. And I think that it's not about them being successful, it's about how they're using their success and how they're using their money. And I think that we as a company, you know, it's written into our legality, is that we're committed to having a social impact, to having an environmental impact, and being better than what's already there, whilst still making money, right? Like, we live in a capitalist society, we can't avoid that, and we want to rise the companies we're working with up as much as our own company and our own team.
Yeah, and there'll always be capitalism, and there is a real deep undercurrent of people that, I think, within the world, that we don't want that.
Yeah.
You want not just spending.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that doesn't have to be, I'm a billionaire and I give money away. It can be as simple as your company pays your staff really, really well. Your company gives a certain amount of profits to, you know, environmental organisations or charities that you care about. I mean, Patagonia has literally just like changed its entire structure as a company to give profits to the planet, in whatever sense that means. So I think that, you know, we're starting to see a shift. It doesn't mean that we're expecting people to give up capitalism and money. We understand that if, you know, ideologically speaking, if we're going to sort of challenge capitalism, we're talking about centuries of social change which would have to take place. So instead, again, perfectionism being the hindrance of progress, let's not try and do that right now. Let's try and make a better world to live in and a better community to be a part of. And that can be a global community. It doesn't need to be so localised all the time.
And just investing in those businesses that want that and those startups, that's so important.
Yeah, we've just posted on our, just posted about companies during Black Friday, which are either participating in Black Friday and therefore you should support them because they're better, you know, companies, they're companies which care, their products are better for the planet, or companies which are taking a stance against it. I think it's Hyatt Denim, which they've just raised their prices by something like 3,650%. So they're the most expensive jeans in the world. But also, if you bought a pair of jeans, you'd plant 450,000 trees because of their policy of planting trees per order, whatever. So, you know, these, no one's going to buy that.
No.
But it's the statement of these companies care and are trying to make a statement. And you can go and support these companies throughout your lifetime without having it, you know, to be some novelty or some campaign.
I kind of like the serendipity of us recording this on Black Friday.
Yeah.
When, and actually I was reading about, it's Green Friday as well.
Yes,
some people,
yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I've never bought anything on Black Friday because I don't want anything that bad.
Well, it's interesting. There have been some studies done which show, and there have been companies penalised for this. For in the run up to Black Friday, their prices incrementally rise, so that when the discount for Black Friday comes, it's actually just the same price it was 6 months ago. And I think that that's really insidious, and then people sort of go, great discount, but actually it's the same price. I'm not saying that all companies do that, but I think it's worth bearing in mind that a lot of traditional companies, we're not talking about the ethical companies here, their primary focus has been to make money for their shareholders. Yes, they might give to charity, yes, they might pay their staff well, but ultimately it's about making as much profit as possible and paying, you know, their top level people very, very, very insidious amounts of money. The point is that what we're starting to see now is companies that engage in Green Friday or Black Friday, if they still call it that, which most don't, it's actually, this is a true discount so that you can start supporting us, start your journey with us, and then you can sort of continue that journey into the new year and onwards and through Christmas and whatever else. And I think what we'll definitely, I mean, there's been boycotts of Black Friday, there's been changes of names of Black Friday, but I think ultimately all that really matters is that wherever you're shopping, whatever day of the year, whatever sale, whatever discount that is, we want it to be from a better company with better products. And you know, once canopy.com is up and live, that's somewhere that you can do that and you can relate to and understand.
So next Christmas is going to be really interesting then for you, isn't it?
Yeah, next Christmas, next Green Friday, next Cyber Monday, whatever, all of these different things. I think as a retail company, you naturally have to partake in some way, whether you're taking a stance or whether you're or whether you're engaging in it in a better way. I think that as a marketplace, which is trying to make it easier for people to shop sustainably, we take the stance, at least we do at the moment, of Black Friday is happening, here are some great companies which are giving discounts and letting you come in, and we want you to be able to buy those places, and many of them sell on our website. So yeah, next Christmas, next Green Friday, it's going to be it's going to be an intense time.
It's
exciting time.
It is going to be exciting for you. Yeah. So just to finish, next is our initiative to engage under 35. So it's not just young professionals kind of doing that. Anyone under 35 in business, if you could just go back, and obviously you're not going back that far because you are very young, what piece of advice would you give to yourself, or what do you, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
Going out and speaking and networking and joining events that are run by, you know, organizations like the Conext Group, various other things. And I think that I've learned that along the way. I, you know, was involved with Greenpeace from 18, so I was already out there talking to people. But I think that if I could give advice to people going through that journey now, it's, you know, don't be afraid that you haven't stepped into that world yet. Or whatever world it is you're going into, you can go and speak to people and there'll be a lot more that you can relate to them than you think. And actually, one thing that I think is really important is that no matter whether you are a young teenager who has no experience of work, you've just finished your GCSEs maybe, or whether you're Jeff Bezos, who, you know, is one of the richest people in the world, and everyone in between, we all have imposter syndrome. Every single person at some point feels like they are punching above their weight. Going back to Chris Sarker, who's the investor from Silicon Valley, he talks about it quite openly. You know, he's one of, if not the most successful investors of his time in the tech world, and yet he feels imposter syndrome every time he sits down and interviews a company. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so true. And as a founder, it can't be any more true. You know, you pitch, you talk about your company, you're selling that every day, you're talking about the future, and a lot of the time it all feels like bullshit. But so long as you keep moving, so long as you keep talking to people, so long as you keep building, every little bit of progress is better than none. So it's all about being better, not best, and talking to as many people as you can.
I love that. That's perfect. It's about being better. I love that. That's a great way to end. Thomas, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having
me.
You've been listening to the Norfolk Chamber of Commerce podcast, connecting, supporting, and giving voice to every business in Norfolk.